The Voice of America presents The American Agenda. The American Agenda examines today's critical issues, important ideas, and significant trends in the United States.
Welcome to The American Agenda. I'm Neil Levine. On this edition of the program, we'll hear an archival interview with the late poet Allen Ginsberg, who talks about his life and the influence of Buddhism on his art. Here's VOA's Adam Phillips.
Father Death, don't cry anymore. Mama's there underneath the floor. Brother Death, please mind the sore.
That's the voice of poet Allen Ginsberg, who died on April 5th, 1997. The half-sad, half-humorous tone of this musical poem about death was typical of Mr. Ginsberg, who came of age artistically during the San Francisco Beat Movement of the 1950s, along with Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, and other poets and artists now recognized for their greatness. In his 1994 interview with me, Allen Ginsberg explained how his poetic and personal understanding of such issues as mortality and the mind dovetailed with what Buddhists call the Four Noble Truths.
One, being born, you're going to die. Everybody knows that, and that's pretty basic. But that means that there's going to be some pain at some point or other, or suffering, or some irritability, if nothing else, in the whole process of growing old and dying. So there's going to be some bodily and mental suffering. Secondly, as you get older, you realize that everything is transitory or mutable, or as the Western philosopher Heraclitus said, you can't step in the same river twice. Or as the poet Gregory Corso said, you can't step in the same river once, even. Even the American century, the American empire, as well as the personal self, and the old houses I used to live in as a kid, and the streets I used to walk in, everything changes, and there's no fixed reference point. Everything moves, so there's no permanent selfhood. There's no permanent ego. There's no permanent me, 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 me. Even that is kind of flowing, like water. As the other American poet, Robert Creeley, says, everything is water if you look long enough.
Impermanence as a built-in fact of life was an idea alien to the liberal Jewish milieu into which Allen Ginsberg was born in 1926. Indeed, he was full of socialist idealism when he left his Paterson, New Jersey childhood home bound for New York City. But his views were to change deeply in 1950 during a conversation with Jack Kerouac, the handsome and charismatic writer at the center of what would later become known as the Beat Generation.
As a good young Jewish boy with progressive tendencies, I thought everything would progress and things would get better and better, but he pointed out that existence contained suffering. Being born, we have this flesh and bones, and you can get cancer or old age or teeth fall out or hair fall out or get caught in a snowstorm or slip on the ice, as well as the joys of marriage and babies and music and poetry. So there's a kind of balance in human life between pleasure and awareness of suffering. Once you understand those terms, then you begin to appreciate the beauty of existence as it is, transitory and temporary as it is, like a rainbow in the sky, or like a bubble, or like a fleeting dream, so that actually things are quite free and open.
These insights actually came to Mr. Ginsberg from some strange sources. While gazing out of his apartment window over the tenement rooftops of Harlem, for example, and while looking at Buddhist art, and while getting laughing gas at the dentist.
Maybe I was just discovering it at the age of 22, what kids discover at the age of 12, maybe. Just the enormousness of the universe and the enormousness of my own mind and space, and how ancient everything seemed.
Not that it was all love and light for Mr. Ginsberg. He felt his mother Naomi's horrifying struggle with mental illness deeply, and immortalized it after her death in his epic poem, Kaddish, from which the following is excerpted.
Dreaming back through life, your time and mine accelerating toward apocalypse, the final moment, the flower burning in the day, and what comes after. Looking back on the mind itself that saw an American city, a flash away, and the great dream of me or China, or you and a phantom Russia, or a crumpled bed that never existed, like a poem in the dark, escaped back to oblivion. No more to say.
As a poet, a Jew, and a homosexual, Mr. Ginsburg felt alienated in many ways from the mainstream America of the late 1940s and early 1950s, where he came of age. This sense of personal alienation and urgency was shared by many of his artistic and intellectual friends during the immediate post-war era. He gave voice to their sensibility with his landmark poem, Howl, a small portion of which we hear now.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night.
Many considered the beats outlandish, but what they seemed to want was certainly serious enough, a radical rethinking of the human predicament based on the horrors of the recent past.
I think we reached the peak of civilization with the atom bomb around 1945, and then we realized we could create something incredible that could destroy the world, and that it was one world and one planet, and that it was all a kind of interlinked consciousness in a way, as old religions had always said. And also disillusionment with a series of vast cataclysmic planetary wars, even at the height of technological progress. So it's almost like Western Faustian mechanical progress idea of civilization from the Enlightenment ran into a dead end. And we were posed with problems that couldn't be solved by materialist acquisition, psychological problems. And so people began looking into their own psyches. And that's where the poet comes in and the artist comes in, because the artists have always felt that it was a quality of life and the interrelation of person and soul or feeling or sensitivity that made life worthwhile rather than merely piling up kingdoms and skyscrapers. So as the culture went into a crisis, the artists were a kind of antenna of that crisis and began sounding the alarm. I remember with my own poem, Moloch, whose eyes are 1,000 blind windows, Moloch, whose skyscrapers stand in the long streets like endless Jehovah's, judgmental gods, that is, Moloch, whose love is endless oil and stone, Moloch, whose soul is electricity and banks, Moloch, whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. And then finally, the key phrase, Moloch, whose name is the mind. It's our own minds that have created this Moloch or mass monster, megalopolis, man-eating machine world.
For Mr. Ginsburg, the key to understanding the mind lay in the ancient practice of meditation.
You focus on your breath, and then you find your mind wandering, and you notice your mind is wandering, and you catch yourself thinking, and you appreciate the gorgeousness and weirdness of the thought and the oddity of it. And then on the next breath that you become conscious, you go back to your breath. So it's going back and forth in this very ancient form of meditation between observing the inside and observing the outside, and always coming back. In other words, don't grasp aggressively to fixate any of your thoughts, but allow your thoughts to pass and let go and observe your thoughts rather than thinking that they are objective measurements for what's all around you. They're just thoughts. And then you can apply that experience when in relating to other people and in business and in everyday cooking and walking down the street, that you're at least aware of what's going on around you and in you rather than sort of daydreaming somewhere on another planet.
Ginsburg seemed to feel that simply being on this planet was exotic enough when seen from a mystic perspective. As a young man, in fact throughout his life, Mr. Ginsburg was drawn to the work of Western visionary artists, such as the American poet Walt Whitman and the apocalyptic 17th century British poet and painter William Blake. Here is a short excerpt from Ginsburg's reading of his 1956 poem, Sunflower Sutra, in which he addresses the soul of a dead sunflower he saw in a train yard, its form dusted with the soot of old locomotives and industry.
and you there, standing before me in the sunset, all your glory in your form, a perfect beauty of a sunflower, a perfect, excellent, lovely sunflower existence, a sweet natural eye to the new hip moon, woke up alive and excited, grasping in the black light, shadow, golden, sunrise, sunset, monthly breeze.
It was exhilarating for Allen Ginsberg that there were many other poets and artists, such as Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, Michael McClure, Philip Whalen, and Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who shared this risky and ecstatic view of life. In about the mid-50s, these beats, as they called themselves, coalesced into their own distinct culture, creating what history has now come to call the San Francisco Bay Area Renaissance.
And the literature that was produced was so intense and interesting and vivid that it's still very popular among the younger people, generation after generation.
The iconoclasm and the energy of the Beat Renaissance were American to the core. But the Eastern thought and spirituality that ran through it produced some fascinating new artistic hybrids.
So that in music, painting, and literature, as well as in film, with the underground films that began to develop what we now know as music video with jump cuts and montage and quick changes from one image to another, reproducing the nature of what how the mind works.
This influence of Eastern ideas on Western avant-garde art was further enhanced during the 1950s when the Chinese invasion of Tibet caused many intelligent and highly trained Buddhist monks or lamas to leave their far-off homeland and begin teaching in Europe and the U.S.
Instructing Westerners in very, very old arts of meditation and arts of calligraphy, flower arranging, the martial arts, sitting practice of meditation, haiku writing, doha or sloka writing. There's a four-line poetic form where you sum up your mind at the moment spontaneously.
This is the lofty green mountain sky fortress. At the palace of the sky fortress, above dark clouds gather, below blue rivers flow, behind the red rock sky fortress.
This long, spontaneous poem was composed by the Tibetan black sorcerer turned sage Milarepa. It's being chanted by American Buddhist practitioners.
Deer and wild horses, mothers and young play and frolic.
The poets, most of all, enjoyed it, as for Kerouac, because the old Tibetan tradition was of spontaneous mind. That is, the greatest Tibetan poet was Milarepa, of, I guess, the 10th or 11th century, who was illiterate but who spoke the most beautiful poetry, which his students took down. And that's the popular, as well as esoteric poetry of Tibet. And then you have Kerouac in America, who never revised, but uttered his poetry spontaneously or wrote it down in pencil and on a pad quickly. And is a seminal poet for American imaginative arts.
Here is a rare recording of Jack Kerouac himself reading from his poem, October in the Railroad Earth, accompanied by Steve Allen on the piano.
There was a little alley in San Francisco, back of the Southern Pacific Station at 3rd and Townsend, in red brick of drowsy, lazy afternoons with everybody at work in offices. In the air, you feel.
This is how Mr. Ginsberg later came to explain the concept of spontaneous mind as he understood it.
Recognizing what you're thinking just while you're thinking it or just after you're thinking it, and noticing your own thoughts, or training to catch yourself thinking, and then to notice what you notice and observe what's vivid, and not to edit it so much as to realize that vividness is self-selecting. So you work with what you actually see passing through your mind, rather than trying to ignore the activity of the mind and stick to some fixed pre-programmed, solidified plot, if you're writing a novel or a poem. You work your present mind into the composition that you're making right then and there, as in Western jazz and some of Western poetry. First thought, best thought.
By the early 1960s, Mr. Ginsberg had already become a famous poet, and he went to India for a few years in search of foreign inspiration. When he returned, America was already deeply embroiled in the Vietnam War. He became a leader of the psychedelic counterculture that opposed it, often appearing at flower power gatherings and cavorting with the likes of Dr. Timothy Leary and the Beatles. Here's an excerpt from a poem he wrote during that period called Who Be Kind To.
Be kind to yourself, because the bliss of your own kindness will flood the police tomorrow. Because the cow weeps in the field and the mouse weeps in the cat hole. Be kind to this place, which is your present habitation, with derrick and radar tower and flower in the ancient brook.
Ironically, Ginsberg sometimes found himself criticized by the protesting youth whose freedom he had always championed. They felt his politics lacked the hard edge a so-called youth revolution would require. But Ginsberg resisted what he saw as sloganeering, whether it emanated from the left or the right.
You know, rising up angry, or, you know, kill your parents, or... Kerouac put his finger on that. He said a lot of the late 60s left-wing activity was, quote, new reasons for spitefulness, unquote. You know, fight the bourgeoisie rather than understand it. So more compassion was needed.
To the end of his life, Ginsberg continued to use words like understanding, love, and compassion, even when it seemed like no one else would.
Well, compassion is the heart of it all, after all. Everybody wants love. I think that's sort of a basic, whether or not they know it, there still is a longing to be accepted and to be darlinged and to be called honey and to be petted and to be fed and to be cherished. I mean, everybody wants that. And how few of us get it, and how hard we are on ourselves and are on each other is a matter of almost public knowledge at this point. Compassion toward yourself, you know, to treat yourself a little better rather than constantly bemoan the fact that you're not the billionaire president of United Supermarket Spaceships.
Born in this world, you got to suffer. Everything changes. You got no soul.
You got no soul.
Try to be gay. Ignorant, happy.
To accept the fact that this transitory self suffers, and to accept the fact that it's not going to be here forever, and to relate to that fact in a way that doesn't is resentful, isn't afraid, isn't mad at the fact that it's not going to be around like God for a billion years. That sort of fits the Buddhist bill. And it's also my own experience.
Allen Ginsberg died of cancer and stroke on April 5, 1997. Thousands of admirers attended his funeral in New York City. Some eulogized the man with his own now famous summation. Well, while I'm here, I'll do the work. And what is the work? To ease the pain of living. Everything else, drunken dumb show. We close this issue of American Agenda with Allen Ginsberg's own playful song on this subject. I'm Adam Phillips.
Act like you talk, work like the sun. Shine in your heaven. See what you've done. Come down and walk.
Come down and walk.
Sit, you sit down. Breathe when you breathe. Lie down, you lie down. Walk where you walk.
Walk where you walk.
Talk when you talk. Cry when you cry. Lie down, you lie down. Die when you die.
Die when you die.
Look when you look. Hear what you hear. Just